Hello everyone and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business and esports. I'm your host, Joe Hills, the founder of Looking for Group, and we have a very special episode for you, focusing around the intersection between two of the top buzzwords for this year in business, which are esports and blockchain. Today we are joined by Brian Kerr, the former founder and CEO of Fnatic Gear, who has recently turned into an esports investor as the managing director for GL Ventures based out of San Francisco. Brian, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So we've been having a bit of a back and forth over the last few weeks discussing the investment potential around any and all blockchain platforms and products in and outside of the esports industry. But before we get stuck down into that, it'll be great just to hear your story, the highlights of your journey of how you got to where you are now and your history as a gamer in your personal life.
Yeah, that's a long, long thing to go through in all the little pieces. I'll try to give a high level summary.
Sure.
And just take out all the fluff. I guess most relevant to people in gaming is when I was 14, I was ruthlessly addicted to video games. I mean, even before that, I was playing a lot of StarCraft. And when I first got my Nintendo at 5 years old, it was just downhill from there. I'm pretty sure you could probably plot like my school grades and intelligence, and it just would be on a linear chart going down as my age went up. But when I was 14, I got really, really into Warcraft 3. And I guess similar to you doing podcasts back then, we had audio commentaries where before Twitch and YouTube, everybody, the only way to share what happened in a game was you would post a replay of the match. And then other guys would do an audio commentary on top of it, talking about all the moves and what's happening in the match and everything else. And other people would go onto a website and download the file on the MP3 and then play it on Winamp or wherever else, and then try to sync it up the best they could as they watched the replay on their computer. So I did a bunch of those for WCReplays.com.
Very nice.
And then I somehow got to be number one in on US West on the server, which still wasn't very good compared to the Asia guys. And then played in the World Cyber Games. Didn't go very far, but you know, took the whole thing very, very seriously as a young teenager. And that was like my foray and what made me love esports, just following the guys like Grubby and Moon, who were the top players in the world in that game. Which, you know, let's just fast forward to, you know, my post-college life. I still had that love and passion for esports and gaming. I thought it was the coolest thing, but I also fully realized it would never be a job. my biggest dream would just be, oh, maybe I could work at PlayStation as a game tester or something.
Yeah.
And it just, it's like, what a sad idea that was.
I had exactly like the same thought. I was just in the back of my parents' car one day and I just chirped up and said, Dad, one day I'm going to be a games tester. And Dad just turned around and was just like, you do something proper with your life. But there was no other obvious.
I mean, if you're extra ambitious, you say you're going to be a game developer, then you have no idea what that even means. Like, you're just like, well, I'm going to design some 3D shapes, but really what you are then is you're just like a skins designer or like a level designer. And that's still not very great in the grand scheme of the world. You still have everybody else who actually owns the IP and runs the company of the game studio. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Oh, and just if there's anybody listening in California, I want to crush all the schools that teach game design because they just rip off all the kids. I don't know any single good game school or game design school that's actually not just taking $50,000 a year from the kids' parents and getting them out on the streets, and then they can't get a real job and then they end up as a games tester.
Wow.
But during college, I had a very short internship with a marketing agency called the Kenwood Group. And at Kenwood, they had me do all sorts of just random production stuff, but their clients were Square Enix and NVIDIA and a bunch of other game publishers. So it was just right up my alley, even though a lot of it was really boring stuff. And what was, so I was at one of these, you know, management consulting jobs, and then I got a call from Kenwood, and they said, hey, you know, we need somebody to do business development. We liked working with you when you were an intern. Do you want to come and help us? And I said, yes, I would love that. And I ended up being their Pete Campbell. If you've ever seen Mad Men, I was the guy who's running around trying to find new clients and, trying to pitch them projects. And that turned into a really cool learning experience because I was working side by side with some world-class creative directors that had done, you know, very large product launches, campaigns, and events. And that was sort of my first foray into gaming.
Wow, super exciting. Like, I still, after that example, expect that you were swigging whiskey all day and smoking a 20-a-day while you were doing it. But, how did you get to starting up with the periphery brands?
I knew I wanted to start a company, and I actually put two pitch decks together, business plans together. And one was for energy drink for gamers. And then the other one was for a peripheral brand that I was calling like a Beats by Dre of gaming gear. And, when I left, Fnatic reached out to me and they said, hey, we need somebody as a director full time. Come help us and, you know, shape this thing into a real business. And, you know, you can work with our sponsors and you can do our marketing campaigns with them and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, no, that sounds horrible. I don't want to do that. I want to start one of these companies. And I shared those decks with them and they thought both were really interesting. And they said, okay, why don't we team together and you work on fleshing these out for, you know, however long it takes. And in the meantime, help us with on our business side of things. So that's what I did. I flew to London, worked hand in hand with Anne for quite some time and Patrick. And it took actually about a year before we really, really said, all right, we're green lighting this peripheral company. Mm-hmm. And that's what ultimately turned into Fnatic here.
It's quite a bold move, to plug in a periphery platform into a esports brand at all. I mean, even back then, if you look at the brand with some of the strongest exposure and fan following, you know, that is your the organization to actually join. But if you look at esports being a PC dominant market where a lot of people have actually grown up with certain brands that they prefer, you know, I've always used a Logitech mouse. How do you go about positioning that platform in a market where a lot of the fans actually will follow the players over the teams? Like, it must have been quite an arduous process to go through.
The thing that was attractive to us about the peripheral market, you know, I won't give numbers, but, you know, we had this SteelSeries partnership where Fnatic had done a series of co-branded products. We, you know, had a co-branded mouse. We had a co-branded mouse pad headset and whatnot. And we actually saw the sales data of those products because we're getting royalties on all of them. And so we knew that there was a market for people that didn't just want a regular SteelSeries product, but they actually really just wanted a Fnatic branded product.
Okay.
And those numbers alone, helped us make that decision. And we understood that, you know, hell, if we did this company and we spun off and we dropped, you know, what's a great, SteelSeries was a great partner for Fnatic, very, very good partner. Mm. You know, if we sacrifice this and risk this, what is the upside? And the upside was we knew that there was already an audience there. And we knew that if we, basically the risk was, yes, maybe it's only the Fnatic fans that like these products, right? It's not going to be Logitech, which maybe can be over a ton of teams and, you know, kind of agnostic for every gamer. We knew that that was a risk, that we get stuck in the Fnatic fan base as the purchasing group. But even in that scenario, we knew that we would come out financially ahead, after we spun off the business. So just the return of just that group alone was worthwhile to take that risk. And anything else was just sort of upside. So that made our decision pretty easy.
Super smart. So you built that up over the course of a few years. What was the reason for you making an exit from the business?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long journey. I mean, it was, you know, a year or two, let's say, so from 2014 to 2017 was when Fnatic Gear was really just pumping through. And, Fnatic Gear was more than just peripherals. It was also the clothing, the merchandise and apparel and everything else. And,
yep.
You know, over that time, so when we first started, when we launched on Indiegogo, I was still, you know, it was basically like a team of four. It was a lot of people doing a lot of the heavy lifting. Like we didn't have the infrastructure, like a team of salespeople, you know, people that were directly ahead of R&D. It was kind of me just sort of block and tackling everything that popped up, along with Sam, who was really involved at the time, a guy we hired named Henry, who worked with us more on the online side of things. And then we had Arvid, who was doing the products. And, you know, that little team there, we quickly scaled that out. And, you know, thankfully, over 2 years, we now have a real head of R&D that we got from Corsair. Mm-hmm. We brought on a sales guy who was another rival brand, and he knew the ropes there. And it wasn't me running around, like, because I was doing products and sales and everything, I was running to all these distributor partners all over Europe. I was still living back home in San Francisco officially, and we had our headquarters in London, but I was always also flying to China. And sort of this back and forth of everything got really exhausting. And I think that at the end of 2017, personally, I just really needed to change. I wanted to be close to my girlfriend, which my travels were causing a lot of troubles to. And I think that I felt like I had given up a lot of my life to spin off this company, and I was happy I did that. But it was also time to kind of add value into the world in a different way.
So you took a little bit of time off, and you launched your new venture at the start of this year, focusing around esports media and entertainment investment. We've been speaking over the last few weeks about the blockchain space specifically. I know you're already involved with one organization as an advisor. The main focus of this episode was to kind of understand the convergence between esports and blockchain and just how much potential there is in the market for a marrying of the two. But before we get stuck into the detail, would you take a few minutes just to conceptualize what blockchain actually is,
its
value to business, and kind of, you know, what is it past a, you know, decentralized, incorruptible, and secure network? You know, what is the true product?
Yeah, so blockchain is, it's a funny thing because you have people running around spouting Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, blockchain this, decentralize that.
Sure.
And there's actually very few videos or, you know, online educational pieces that can, in a snapshot, describe what it is.
Yeah.
The important things to understand about blockchain is not necessarily, you know, what it does for a particular business or how it will change things. At a high level concept, what's really important to understand about it is that in any situation where there is a transaction, blockchain can bring transparency to the two parties of that transaction while completely removing the counterparty risk that they would have normally in dealing with each other. So, for example, a title company for a house, you could make a title company on the blockchain instead of, you know, requiring to have title company, the title company to have insurance or to hold the down payment or the total money of the house as the two parties swap the titles, you know, the purchaser and the seller. Instead, you can just make a smart contract that does that. You can make a smart contract that will receive money from one party, receive the title from the other party, and basically put them both in like a temporary escrow or do an atomic swap. So like just a fast swap of both things.
Sure.
Or an instantaneous swap. So there is no risk that one person's going to get both at the same time. Like the one person receives the money while they still hold the title. Like you just remove that risk altogether by basically writing it in programming language. And that's what's really cool. One part of blockchain, you remove all this counterparty risk that exists. And that includes everything from fraud and transaction issues. So like these big payment companies like Visa, Discover, MasterCard, they're actually in a pretty crappy spot right now. they need to figure out how they're going to continue to justify 1-2% transaction fees on everything just to take the liability and the risk on it. It's because in the future you have blockchain and there is no risk. There isn't a whole lot of liability there. So their whole business model is either going to be knocked down and removed, or it's going to be shrunk drastically over the next few years. So they're like scrambling to figure out how to adapt and how to get up with the times. Mm-hmm. And then the last piece of blockchain is this idea of having a distributed ledger. Everyone has a record of all the transactions, and in a decentralized network, rather than having a centralized governance system, you have some type of voting system. So just for example, if somewhere in the future we had a small town, and instead of having, elected officials to this town, you would actually just have each house would be worth a vote. Sure. In the town. It's not who donates more money. It's not who gets elected. It's none of that. It would just be each person has one vote, and you ensure that, unless someone actually owns 51% of the houses, they wouldn't be able to control what's going on in that city. And blockchain is similar. Like, there's usually some majority or supermajority ruling, and you want to keep it as decentralized and as many sort of parties owning or having ownership stake in the voting system as possible. What's really cool with blockchain is, aside from being able to create a system where you have these records of all the votes and you can't change it, which is what blockchain enables, you also have a number of blockchain companies which are actually tackling this idea of identity. So it's like, why do we have all these logins for every website? Why can't a website or the internet just know who I am and say, all right, this is Brian. He's now just looking at Facebook. We should show him his Facebook. Like, why don't we have that yet? Well, the internet didn't have that sort of forethought in mind. But these blockchain companies are starting to develop systems and ways of verifying and checking identity. So one example is a company called Civic. Yeah. And they have it's an app that you have on your phone, and instead of two-factor authentication, using sort of a Google two-factor, anytime you log in, you can just put your you can log in with Civic rather than a login with Facebook, and it's secure. And then on your phone, you just give them your fingerprint or whatever other safety you want to do, facial scan, and what have you. So they can always trust it's actually you. And while it's not a perfect system, it's much better than what we have today. Mm-hmm. And I think the more we move to that, the more you can trust it is truly going to be one-for-one voting and in a system, because they would just, log in versus on Civic and then cast their vote. And okay, because the blockchain counted the vote, it's not tempered with, and we accept it. It's true. And then we also believe that this person cast that vote, and that's true. And there's no counterparty risk here. And great, we count this as one vote from this person.
Super smart. I mean, I'm going to have to stop you there on that point, because I think, as I said beforehand, if we go over 45 minutes, my producer starts to get violent. Really cool. One or two bits and bobs to go over before we part ways. And we've established the foundation for the concept of blockchain and what it can bring to business. But let's refocus it down to esports specifically. I've been speaking with Jens at Bitcraft, as well as a few other VCs and tech developers that are looking at esports platforms, either around talent management or, just basically a 360 degree mm-hmm. of solutions for the industry. If you had to characterize the kind of two or three main areas where you see blockchain products having the most value in esports outside of the kind of day-to-day higher level operations of how businesses interact, what would they be?
So I will very quickly default into two companies I'm working on along with Alex, sure. Who's the founder of Navi. The first one is the one that I'm publicly advising, called D-Market. And that is, part esports because there's skins and other things involved, but it's also just gaming in general. And that's a decentralized marketplace for virtual and in-game goods, where any gamer can monetize their time and skill and whatever they earn in-game, sell it on a marketplace for tokens, and then cash out those tokens for actual cash, or trade amongst themselves for other skins and other things. And what exists today is a Steam marketplace, and that holds 6% of sort of all the games. And, you know, you have Counter-Strike, PUBG, and you can trade skins and other things on there. But what you don't have is an open marketplace, which is what Dmarket is. And that means that Candy Crush, Zynga games, any game that you imagine can tie in with the API. And any gamer who earns anything on those platforms can then sell what they've earned, whether it be experience, coins, skins, what have you, on the marketplace, sell it for a common currency, and then port that and either use that to just, you know, have some cash or to buy something in a different game. So you have a cross-platform marketplace over mobile, console, PC, VR and AR and anything else you can imagine. And just on a scaling note, like, that just wasn't possible before blockchain.
Sure.
So that's what's really cool there. So I think that's one big area. The second big area is a project that Alex is working on now, and that's called dreamteam.gg. And if I was to encapsulate it, I would say that the thesis of me as a VC is that, yes, there's lots of infrastructure missing, but if I had to choose one big piece within esports that's missing today, it's that you have all these separate gaming communities, and unless you're Twitch or Amazon, you don't have a lot of data on who these people are and what they like and what games they're interested in, what are their patterns. Like, there's just very little data on these people to market products to. So what Alex is building is, you can consider it like a LinkedIn for gamers, where people would have profiles, you would tie in your Steam account, you tie in other accounts from other games. It tracks what achievements you accomplish. You can write up a resume. You can look for groups. Say you want to be an 80 carry in a team of five. It's like, how do you find that right now? And how do you judge who those other five people are, aside from like really crappy badges within League of Legends, and their win-loss record? Like, it's pretty bad. So this would be a LinkedIn for gamers, where you have skills and you can find people, you can basically do recruiting, but for your team. And then also it provides a host of other sort of services and platforms for team management, which I think is also really needed.
Super, super cool. And that's something that I'll be keeping an eye on in the future. We have T-minus 3 or 4 minutes left.
Okay. Well, let me give the listeners the third one, which I think is also a really cool one.
Okay.
And this is the last piece of the blockchain that I'm actually also working on. So I love gaming, so of course I'm going to choose the three that I think are most relevant to gaming to actually work on myself. And the third one is using the internet as it is structured right now, and a series of VPNs. I could get really technical, but the idea is you can actually make a VPN that's faster rather than slower, to host, game traffic. And, there's a company right now called Haste.net, which is doing some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
But you can take what they built, which is, you know, their own mesh network and VPN network for gamers, and actually make that open and decentralized. So, you know, anyone can post up both a node for people to pass their traffic through. So there's a lot of game servers in Chicago. People can pop up their own servers and be compensated by tokens that way. And then everyone can just go directly through that node, and they'll actually reach the game servers faster. So you'll see this, like, basically if you make a mesh network across the globe of these servers, you can have people play games at, you know, much faster speeds than even their ISP would typically give them. So you reduce a lot of the boundaries between, say, me in the United States playing you in the UK.
Mm.
So I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's really smart. I was actually playing a PUBG for the first time in ages. I joined a YouTuber that I watch. He has a Discord, and it's easier to hop on there and actually play with people that have a brain rather than trying to matchmake with randoms. And we were playing with some Australian dude, and his lag was actually super helpful for us, because he just kept kind of popping around corners with his shotgun.
Well, I guess if you like the lag, then that's fine. You don't need that at all.
Yeah, so that was pretty damn helpful. Brian, the insight into blockchain is super appreciated, and I think that we're really just seeing the tip of the iceberg on this. Over the next few years, I expect a lot more of these platforms and products to restart changing the way that, well, all businesses, it's really done. And it's going to be, a case of, like what you mentioned earlier, will the non-endemic and legacy industries and organizations be able to re-pivot and utilize this technology in the same way? We've seen some sluggish reception of esports because it just seems like there is a raw generation gap between the active consumers and the senior decision makers the world over. Also, esports isn't quite ready for a lot of these plays by traditional sports teams, but it's a super exciting time to be involved in the market, and I'm super keen to see how your projects move forward. We were going to try and touch on the impact of franchising with League of Legends and Overwatch on the esports ecosystem, and what big areas of investment are going to be the kind of key priority for the industry as a whole. Leaving blockchain aside for a second, what's kind of a 1 or 2 minute idea that you feel like the next large areas of investment in the space will be coming from?
Yeah, so blockchain aside, I think that you can look at sort of the professional teams and the franchising as, you know, pumping in a ton of money into the space that, you know, I think it was really needed to elevate the industry as a whole. But what I think you'll see is it's actually going to create this sort of cavern of, or this chasm between the professional gamers that have, you know, these millions and millions of dollars to operate and these amateur professional gamers, which are, you know, high school students just trying to scrap together a team and try to compete. Sure. And I think what that leaves room for is you have all this sort of middle group, which currently doesn't have infrastructure and support. And these are things such as national leagues, college leagues and organizations, sure, and high school leagues. And I think that anything that's going to be supporting them, or, you know, even as simple as someone who's going to facilitate a place for gamers to congregate that, you know, maybe want to be semi-professional or they're spectators, but they're not at that professional level. I think that those four groups all are going to have a series of needs, and there's hardware needs, there's social and communication needs, and there's also physical, like, infrastructure needs. So, like, where is their meeting space? How are they getting together? And how is that all operating? So I think that those three areas will be really important to see big investments in. Sure. I think that the companies that are going to come in and fill that space are still question marks right now. But I think that there's definitely a huge opportunity there because that's where the majority of the esports audience lives. And, you know, whatever company comes in and meets their needs is actually going to have a direct communication line with the majority of folks in the space.
Sure. I mean, directly, I've seen about 60 to 65 million being invested in these grassroots tournament platforms like Smash GG and Challenge Me and Challenger Mode and the like. So hopefully there'll be more of the same to actually fill out the rest of the esports pyramid. We've got one quick recurring segment that I'm sure listeners from last week will be really hoping that I've got a new name for. Unfortunately, that's not the case. So we're going to be moving on to the dream job section where I ask guests if they're going to have any role in esports that is pro-facing, so being a pro player, a coach, or a manager of a team. What game would it be and what role would it be? You can be a pro player in any title, past, present, or future.
I have the best answer for this because we had this fantasy within Fnatic for the longest time. We were like, well, so the answer is I would be a mascot. We don't have mascots in esports. And we had this grand scheme to have a Fnatic box, and someone would have to go to all of our events and, like, come on stage in this Fnatic fox costume and start breakdancing and doing flips and, like, cheer the crowd.
That's amazing.
And I think that is really missing from esports. I think you need some type of mascot. And I mean, yeah, I guess Unicorns of Love, their manager is getting close to that.
Yeah, but, that's what I was going to go to. That is an amazing answer. And maybe when the esports amphitheaters are slightly larger, we can get the cheerleaders out too. We can have, you know, lots of mid-break entertainment. And we can make it the whole nine yards of extra stuff around the games themselves. Very, very smart answer. I love it. We've just run out of time, Brian, so I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you so much for coming back on. As this area of the market starts to pick up more pace, we might have to have you back on to have a state of the nation about how this area of the market has moved forward in the future.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I love talking about all things esports, blockchain, and crazy tinfoil hat.
Awesome, man. Cool. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Esports Roundtable podcast. Please continue to send all of your feedback over to LFG Esports HR on Facebook and Twitter. Brian, I don't actually have your social media stuff in front of me right now.
Yeah, so on the Twitters, I'm Brian H. Kerr. Same thing on Instagram, Brian H. Kerr. You can find me there.
Fantastic, Brian. Well, guys, we've got a cracking set of episodes on the way out over the next few weeks. We've got the global head of esports from NVIDIA coming on. We've got a global head from Mark Sig with an emerging esports holding company, which is going to be making massive moves in the Texas area over the next few months, as well as much more. So please do stay tuned at the Esports Roundtable podcast.